Good morning. Thanks for coming back to Midpoint Wednesday on WMNF, your independent community radio in Tampa, Florida. I'm your host, Shelley Reback. We're happy to have you with us. As we do on most shows, we're going to start the show with a little tour around some of the new laws and news that most affect us here in West Central Florida, and then we'll get into our focus topic, which today is police accountability and the new laws signed by Governor DeSantis ostensibly to protect police officers. We'll be talking with my guest, James Shaw, former chair of the statewide ACLU legal panel, and Dr. Carolyn Hepburn Collins hopefully will be joining us by telephone. Dr. Collins serves on the City of Tampa Citizens Police Review Board. But first, I want to bring your attention once again to the cruelty of our supermajority Republican legislature and our Republican governor. They got together and passed a new law that forbids local municipalities, our cities and counties, from enforcing any ordinances that require companies to provide heat and water breaks for their employees who work outdoors, for any employees who work outdoors in Florida. Before this new law, Miami-Dade was the first municipality to pass a law that guaranteed that employees working outdoors would have to be given heat and water breaks. Miami-Dade's effort to require shade and water for construction, farm, and other outdoor workers in Florida, one of the hottest states in the nation, is now void. You know, around 2 million people in Florida work in outdoor jobs, from construction to agriculture, according to the Union of Concerned Scientists. And as our listeners know, on average, the state's summer can reach up to 95 degrees, with the humidity and the blazing sun making it feel well over 100 frequently. But the bill's sponsor, Republican Representative Tiffany Esposito of Fort Myers, has said about this law, "This is very much a people-centric bill. If you want to talk about health and wellness, and you want to talk about how we can make sure that all Floridians are healthy, you do that by making sure that they have a good job. And in order to provide good jobs, we need to not put businesses out of business." That was Republican Representative Tiffany Esposito of Fort Myers, the sponsor of this bill that precludes requiring employers of outdoor workers to give them heat and water and shade breaks. Last summer, if you've been with us on Midpoint for a while, last summer you know that in the middle of our extraordinary heat wave, I did a show on Midpoint with Professor Thomas Bernard of the USF College of Public Health about heat stress and about the dangers of working in the record-breaking heat that we were experiencing. If you'd like to know more on this topic, you can always go back to the Midpoint archives and you can stream that show from WMNF.org/midpoint. If you can't find it, just send me an email to midpoint@WMNF.org and leave me a message with your email and I'll send you a link to that show. Now, next, DeSantis signed a sweeping education reform bill also that includes, among other things, limits on the number of book challenges that a person can make if they are not a parent of a student in a school district. The bill, which is House Bill 1285, limits the number of books a person who is not a student's parent or guardian can challenge to one challenge per month. And the goal is to limit the influx of book challenges to school districts. Because as you know, during the 2022-23 fiscal year, there were more than 1,200 book objections in Florida, according to state records. And we think that those records are low. More than half of these challenges came from two counties alone, Clay and Escambia counties. In fact, Florida leads the nation in public school book bans, with 1,406 books banned in total, and that's across the state. That's about 40% of total book bans reported in the United States. And of course, the districts across the state have specifically removed books that are focused on LGBTQ and race-centric issues. So this bill, this new bill that DeSantis signed last week, also institutes new requirements for school districts that want to turn a school into a charter school. The bill makes it easier. The law, it's a new law now, not just a bill, and it makes it easier to turn a school into a charter school. And it includes requiring that the new charter school give enrollment preference to students of that former so-called failing public school. And it prohibits school districts from charging any leasing fees to the charter school company for the facility. And of course, many of those charter school companies are for-profit management companies. It also makes more provisions for schools that offer a classical education and for teachers who seek a classical education degree. Midpoint also did a show about that, about the classical education promotion in Florida, and you can find that in our archives as well. And we know that DeSantis is a huge proponent of the classical education movement, which is very popular among conservative and Christian evangelical groups. Now to the issue at hand. Governor DeSantis and the legislature's efforts to, as they claim, protect the police, and I have air quotes around that because we're on radio, but the governor signed two new laws about that this week. One new law preempts any authority of local municipalities to impanel the independent citizen review boards to investigate police misconduct. And the law requires that citizen review boards in Florida, which are intended to provide independent oversight of law enforcement actions, the law requires that those CRBs, the citizen review boards, be reestablished so that members are now only appointed by a sheriff or a police chief and that at least one member be a retired law enforcement officer. So much for independence. The other new law makes it illegal, after a person has been warned, to approach first responders or to remain within 25 feet of the first responders as they are performing a legal duty, if the person's intent is to interfere, threaten, or harass them. Now, this new law doesn't prevent people from recording law enforcement per se, but it certainly can require them to move 25 feet back, which can make it more difficult. Now, to discuss these new laws and more, I've invited Attorney James Shaw, the former chair of the Florida ACLU's statewide legal panel. So welcome to Midpoint, James.
Thanks, Shelley. Thanks for having me.
And you, our listeners, are also invited into the discussion, which you can join by calling us at 813-239-9663 or by emailing us at dj@wmnf.org or by texting us at 813-433-0885 during the live show. So now, James, tell us about this new law that seems to restrict local municipalities, citizen review boards that are supposedly intended to provide some accountability and oversight of police, particularly police misconduct. And you've been quoted in the press as saying that this law is pretty much moot as to the Tampa CRB because of the way that the Tampa board is structured and the way that it operates. So tell us about this law and tell us what you mean by your statements about this law.
Sure. Well, first, this law doesn't exist in a vacuum. The canvas it's painted on is the Police Officers' Bill of Rights, which is a statute that was enacted long before this. So under the Police Officers' Bill of Rights, an old joke was, if you want to see how due process is supposed to work, look at an internal affairs investigation. It gives a police officer who is accused of misconduct a lot of rights as to what happens next. So one of the things that the Police Officers' Bill of Rights requires is that no one may investigate or discipline the officer other than that officer's employing agency. So if the mayor's office or if a CRB or if any other political subdivision receives a complaint against an officer, the Police Officer's Bill of Rights, or the PBR, as it's often shorthand referred to, requires that complaint to be sent within 5 business days to the police officer's employing agency, and then the public records laws cease to apply until the investigation is completed or ceases to be active. Those are the terms in the PBR. So
that means if I want to know what the status of a complaint against a police officer is or how that investigation, internal affairs investigation, is proceeding, I'm not entitled to see those public records.
You are not, and neither is the Citizen Review Board. It is happening behind closed doors. In fact, there's even a provision in the PBR which was held unconstitutional under the First Amendment by the 11th Circuit that says the person who complained is not allowed to talk about it.
Right?
The legislature, while they were in there, did not remove the part that was declared unconstitutional, and in fact, during the efforts to have the CRB ordinance revamped in Tampa, the PBA's attorney even tried to rely on that and said that it was valid.
The complainant against an officer can't even see how the investigation is proceeding as it's going on.
Right. And the PBR also provides that the officer gets to have counsel, gets to review all the evidence, gets to have a copy of the whole file, gets to record any interviews, and all the rights are set forth as to, you know, they have a lot of protection through that process. So only when it's over do the records become available to the public under Florida's public records laws. Florida's constitution has a very strong right of the public to view public records. So only then can they come out. And that's the first time that any citizen review panel gets to see these records. It's after the investigation is over.
So they're not after a decision has been made about the fate of the officer who's been complained about. After a disciplinary decision, pro or con, or whatever that disciplinary decision is, after that?
Correct. No, the public does not participate in that. Those decisions are made completely within, you know, behind the blue wall.
Okay.
And then after it's over, that's when a citizen review board like Tampa's gets to look at, and if you look at the language of Tampa's citizen review statute or ordinance, it says that they quote unquote review closed investigations, and most every CRB is enacting ordinance around the state says something to that effect, that the investigation is already, so you're not investigating anymore if the investigation is over. What you're really doing is reviewing a closed investigation.
Of like an audit.
Yeah, it's exactly what that is. They do two things. They read the records of a closed investigation, and then they offer a comment. And in Tampa, they basically say, good job, or we don't think you did a very good job. You should do a better job next time. So they're reading public records, and they're offering comments on them. And I say that because under the Florida Constitution, you have a right to read public records. It says in the Florida Declaration of Rights in Section 24 that every person has the right to inspect or copy any public records. So you can't pass a statute that says everybody except for these CRB members are allowed to read these public records of a closed investigation. They're allowed to read them. And then under Article 1, Section 4 of the Florida Constitution, it says every person may speak, write, and publish sentiments on all subjects, that right can't be taken away. So, and of course, it goes without saying that the First Amendment gives them the power to do this. So what the police unions really wanted was for these CRBs to stop reading these public records and stop commenting on them, because that's all that they do. But those are not constitutionally permissible things to want. You can't pass a statute that says they can't do that. And if you look at the text of HB 601, it doesn't really say what the media is saying that it says. There's been a lot of lazy reporting that says that this HB 601 bans or dissolves CRBs, and it just doesn't do that.
Well, what about the part of the law that says that that it has to be assembled by the executive branch, by the police chief or the sheriff, or that the representatives have to include a retired law enforcement? What about that?
I always think of when Barney Fife would make rules on the Andy Griffith Show, and he would say, rule number one is that you have to obey all the other rules, right? They already could do that. In fact, if you remember, in Tampa, Chief Dugan established the, what did he call it, the the Chief's Advisory Board or something to that effect. I have the name of it written down somewhere. The Chief's Community Impact Team. He put that together in 2020. The City of Belle Isle has the Police Advisory Board. Seminole County has the Seminole County Sheriff's Office Civilian Review Board. And these are boards that were created by the head law enforcement officer, by the sheriff or the chief of police. They have a First Amendment right to take advice from anybody that they want, right? So they already had, I think it's part of the inherent power of the head of the agency to control its day-to-day activities, to impanel an advisory group that gives them advice. The statute simply says, well, you can go ahead and do what you already had the ability to go ahead and do. It says that they can make these 3 to 7 member panels, one of whom has to be a retired law enforcement officer. But it doesn't purport to strip them of the power to do what they had already been doing before the statute was passed, to go ahead and so I'm not sure whether I think that they will do it the way that the statute says, but I don't know that they couldn't do it another way. It doesn't say that they can't appoint a board of 5, members of the clergy or prominent business leaders and take advice from them. Nothing in the statute says that they can't do that. And importantly, and this is the part that I think the media is missing, nothing in the statute says that because the sheriff has done that, no one else can.
Have 2 competing boards. The difference is that the law enforcement agency's committee or whatever you want to call it, their board, they have like a whole PR and communications team behind them to release whatever it is that comes out of their board, whereas the local, like Tampa CRB, for example, has to rely on public media like the Tampa Bay Times to get their message out once they consider a case.
Sure, but that's a matter of how each municipality wants to, what resources they want to provide to their CRBs. But you can have 2 boards. Tampa has 2 boards. It has
Dugan created board.
Right, which was really, it was a farce from the get-go. I think that was created just to say, look, now we don't need a real CRB because we have this pretend
right.
one. I'm not sure that group is even active, but we have the one that was appointed by the chief, and then there's the other one that is appointed by the procedure that's set forth in the ordinance, and You can't say that only one of them's allowed to review public records and the other one's not, or one of them's allowed to offer comments and the other one's not. Nothing in this statute says that these existing CRBs have to stop doing what they were doing. It simply empowers these police chiefs and sheriffs to create their own boards, but I think that they already had the power to do that.
Right. All right. Well, I want to welcome Dr. Carolyn Hepburn Collins to the show, too. She's on the phone with us, and she is a member of the Tampa Citizens Review Board. Dr. Collins, you with us?
Yes, I'm here.
Okay, great. Have you been able to hear our discussion so far?
Listening to the whole discussion, yes, ma'am.
Okay, great. Well, thanks for joining us. Dr. Collins, tell us a little bit about the Tampa Citizens Review Board. And, like, for example, who are the members on the local CRB? And explain to our listeners, how were you all selected? Were you selected by the Tampa Police Chief or the mayor? Or what's the process for the people who serve on the board?
Well, first of all, let me thank you for asking me, and let me indicate clearly that I'm here as a member of the CRB board, but not representing the CRB board. I have that right, as a
sure.
member of the public. So I'm not going to be answering for the board. I'm going to be giving the facts as I know them and the injections as I have experienced them.
Sure.
Listen to what I've heard. I'm going to, by choice, not give you the names of the other members. They would have had the choice. But what I will say, it may not be available now, but when the board was first formed with our mission, we did a fly-in, put it out to the community, and it had all 11 board members with the chair and the co-chair, and then all of the other 9 board members with our pictures listed with our names. If that document is not available now and the community want it, we actually asked them to do a flyer to deal with a different situation, and that is to assist the community, more engage the community, and make sure that it was more transparent on how to file a complaint with District 1, 2, and 3. And I personally think that probably needed to be emphasized more with a online number, a telephone number for the districts.
You're talking about people, members of the public who want to address the Citizens Review Board with some issue about law enforcement, right?
Yes.
And I just originally asked you, like, how were the members of the board selected and who are the current members? Because that's a matter of public record.
Yes, it is. And I can tell you that the members on the current board are all listed. You should be able to go on the website and see them. I'm looking right at the original brochure that we did, and that's what I was trying to say. Rather than trying to give you all the name, it is a matter of public record. I will tell you, Dr. Carolyn Collins is on the board. But I want to go back to what you asked. That's why I was asking you that. You was asking how were we selected.
Yes.
And a little different from I heard the dialogue, and I don't disagree. I appreciate anyone in the community that asks information. And I'm not saying that I'm exactly accurate on everything I say, but let me indicate to you, my understanding is our board was not formed by TPD. I do understand that there were limitations, and there's still limitations on all, if it is 21 boards in the state of Florida, because, and perhaps across the country, is because of the union restriction. But I, as a president, I attended the NAACP National Convention as the Hillsborough County president. And present at that, as well as having had an opportunity with the former mayor to work with them, COPS organization actually was there with United States, which they are from the United States Department of Justice. And there was also a Virginia policing unit that was there. And what they said to those of us that were in the audience is, it is imperative that you go back to your community, get with your mayors. They didn't even say get with the police chief. If your city does not have anything similar to a citizen review board, and they didn't use the word advisory, which I know that there are many that are called citizen advisory, that you need to go back. So what I collected at that particular session was everything I wanted to have on my personal and everything that I wanted to give to someone that I would speak with. So when I got back from Vegas at the convention, I immediately called the mayor, at the time was Mayor Bob Buckhorn, and I asked him if we could meet, that I had some information I wanted to share. I met with him in less than a week of return.
What year was this? When was this, Dr. Collins?
8-9 years ago.
Okay.
And when I met with him within a week of returning, I gave him all of this information. I said, this is critically important with the things that are going on around the country, people that are addressing issues with the police department that they are not pleased with. And we had also been dealing with a situation here where they had had the examination of racial disparity in bicycle stops with Tampa Police Department.
The biking while black issue?
I don't call it back in my black. I call it racial disparity.
Okay.
Except for stops and citations that was made by TPD.
Okay.
I don't want to dignify the. And I understand what you're saying because there's a whole lot of folks, that's what they call it. But that's not what I call it. Right. And so I had an opportunity to take one of my officers, and we were on the committee that had been set up with the chief of police and had an opportunity to understand what COPS was and the Virginia policing program, which was VCPI, whatever it was. And so when I met with the mayor, I said, here, and do we have a board like this? He said, no. I said, if we can consider something like this so that all of the shootings and things that was going on around the country, we had only had Trayvon Martin prior to that here in the state of Florida that had made big news. I said, at least we would have something that will address this.
So let me just clarify. So what you're saying is back in 2015, around 2015, you went to this NAACP conference and you heard about these boards that were being established around the country. And so you took all the information that you got and you went to Bob Buckhorn, who was then the mayor, and said, hey, you know, we should have something like this. And ultimately, something like that was created in 2015 for the city of Tampa, at least, right?
I'm going to say you're exactly right, and I'm not going to give the date because I've been asked that date a number of times.
Well, but from my research, it's 2015 that the board was originally created.
Okay.
And as you've pointed out, it was originally created because of a number of things that were occurring in the community, particularly with regard to interactions between the police and the Black community locally, that suggested that there needed to be some sort of review mechanism, some sort of public accountability for some of these police actions. That's what I'm hearing you say. So what I'd like to know from you, Dr. Collins, is can you give me an example of the work of the CRB currently, as it's currently, you know, configured, as it's currently structured, as you sit on it now, today, before anything that may happen in light of this new law, give us an example of how the board operates.
Very much so. And after the training of the board members, and board members are then seated on the board, we meet on the fourth Tuesday of every month, 6 p.m. in City Hall. Prior to our meeting, probably 2 weeks or more, we received several documents. We received the case that our chair or the vice chair, they are the two that go down and they pick the cases that we want to review. In addition to them picking the cases, there's one other stipulation that we added here in Hillsborough County. No, I'm not going to say Hillsborough County because we are Tampa Police Department and not the sheriff. We pick the cases that we want, or the individuals that come before us with public comments have a problem, and we ask them to go and file a complaint if they have not already filed one. That case is in a sense, is marked for us, and we've requested that once Internal Affairs complete their investigation, that case come back before the CRB and give the results to us.
So wait a minute. I apologize for interrupting you, but you're on the phone, so you can't see me gesture to you. But I want to be clear. Are you saying that your board, the vice chair or the chair, goes to TPD to select a case in advance of the completion of the Internal Affairs investigation and then ask for it to be circled back to the CRB?
We do not review the case until after Internal Affairs, exactly what your current guest stated earlier.
Okay, but do you pick the case? Do you select the case before it's completed?
No, I'm going to repeat this again.
Okay.
It's identical to what the guest said earlier. Investigations are only done by the police department.
Right.
We do no investigations. We are what we say, a citizen review board, and others are citizen advisory boards.
Okay.
We do just what you said earlier. Is it like an audit? Basically, we review the cases once the investigation has been completed. The information, the case, supportive documents are sent to us. When it come to us, it also go to the general public because it's a open a public record then, and they can gain the same thing that we have. We get the case. We review it in detail prior to coming in. We look at it. We determine whether or not it is compliant with the policies and procedures of TPD. They have the policies and procedures attached to the case. So we have the policy and procedure book, and oftentimes they will attach that policy and procedure, and then we tell them whether we agree or disagree. There have been most cases we have agreed with. There are those great cases we have disagreed with. And if we disagree with the case in the process is what you're asking. Excuse me. If we disagree with the case, we send it back, normally with a recommendation asking the police chief to readdress it and tell why we disagreed with it. There have been cases where the police chief have come before us to explain cases, and there have been cases where the police chief have not agreed with us. And there have been cases where policies have been modified, cleared, I would call it transparency in processes that are used within TPD. There have been cases because it is going out that individuals have actually decided to retire or leave the police department if they didn't have the time to retire.
Interesting. So, Dr. Collins, I'm very interested in what you've just said. So even though your board only has the authority to review cases after a disciplinary investigation is completed, even though you are limited to that, you have still managed to, you know, create circumstances where there have been some effective, you know, measures that have taken place as a result of your review. For example, like you said, policies may have changed, cops may have retired, the chief may have come to explain in more detail the results of the investigation. So what I'm hearing you say is that even though you have limitations on what you're able to do, you're still able to be productive in terms of a public review, making the police accountable to the public.
I think it's been transparency, making the police accountable and involved in the community. And I think it's good, and citizen review boards should be maintained, advisory boards should be maintained, because this is something new that we started in this community and in the country, and I think it will be, continue to get better as we go on. But I did hear the Bill of Rights for the police departments across the country. You're up against unions across the country. And I have to just make this one statement. I think that we need to focus on maintaining our citizen review. We need to get to the Hillsborough County Legislative Delegation membership since they are back home, proud of them going back to session next year. And we need to let them know as we meet with them. And it's just not the Citizen Review Board. I think the citizens of the city of Tampa, where we have the TPD Citizen Review Board, that, in my opinion, was created by the mayor. And after the mayor, and I want to say this because I know I can't see you, but once the mayor created this board, there was some difference of opinion between the city council and the mayor initially, because the city council said we wanted to create it so that we would have more. So it's not like it's all TPD. There was an interest in the city council on creating this, and there have been interest in the city council in trying to go for subpoena power and an attorney for the current board.
Right.
But the community is interested in having this. It's supposedly based on statistics and the historical data that we have today since they've been created, has reduced crime. But one thing I can say has happened here in Tampa, despite what our community, media, and anyone else see, we have had an opportunity to do what you just said. We have had positive changes made. We have had intervention made. We've created different documents. We start doing the survey before the city council even asked, working with the New York University group. We also have been going out with the police department to their community meetings in the district. We went with TPD, the CRB and TPD went with the TPD community meeting in District 1, 2, and 3. And the attendance at those meetings was extremely large. And they were able to meet CRB and understand what we do, meet and interact with the policemen from the chief down. And those have been positive things that have come out of this.
Well, I'm so glad to hear you to list those things and to tell our listeners exactly how the CRB has been operating and some of the measures that have occurred because of the operation of the CRB, because I just don't think that there has been, you know, enough coverage of that. And so, you know, that's one of the reasons why I wanted to bring this issue to WMNF's listeners, because I think that there are a lot of people who don't understand that the, even with the limitations that have been put on the CRB, that it has still managed to be effective in some ways in creating additional accountability and transparency for law enforcement. So I thank you, Dr. Collins, for that that information. I'm going to turn to James now to talk about the other section of the new law that was passed as part of the same law that has sought to even more limit the CRBs. The other new law makes it illegal, after a person has been warned, to approach first responders or to remain within 25 feet while they are performing a legal duty if the person's intent is to interfere, threaten, or harass them. Now, this new law doesn't prevent people from recording law enforcement, but it can require them to move 25 feet back, which can make it more difficult unless they have, you know, pretty powerful zoom lens. I have a text message here.
May I just ask, make one more comment?
Yeah,
because that's an interesting one to me, because it reminds me of the Stand Your Ground law.
Yeah.
That, in fact, what was going to sound like, we do one law one year, and a few years later they come back. And I really think the legislators need to interact with the community and with the different individuals so they'll know what they're going for before they pass them. Same thing with the intended changes, which I don't think was for TPD. I think it was for the sheriffs to get a raise and for the sheriff to create the board and for the sheriff to put people on the board. I think it was a waste of taxpayers' dollars. But let me just say one last positive thing before we leave the CRB.
Yeah.
In addition to that, and I think it was valuable to us, we had requested that we kind of get an opportunity to see everything that was coming in. So we get 3 reports every month now, and it shows us all the cases, and anybody in the community can go down and get the same reports that we get. It gives any incident reports with the complaints on a monthly basis that tell you how they came in. We also get where the status of those cases are, and then there's another report that we get. But these are things that we're getting as a result of the CRB, where even the community can monitor it. And if you file a complaint, you can then look and see the status of your complaint.
All right. Thank you, Dr. Collins. I've really got to change topics now, though, because we're running out of time. But thank you very much for being with us on Midpoint today and for giving us your perspective on the CRB as someone who serves on the CRB itself in the city of Tampa. So thank you for that. I have a text message here that says, with regard to the 25-foot new limitation, it says, so if we see police misconduct and we approach an officer to get their name or badge number to report them, could we be arrested? James?
Could you be arrested
is always yes.
I have a colleague who was arrested and he said, what am I being arrested for? And the cop that arrested him said, because you have a bad attitude. So you can be
anybody
arrested for having
can
a bad
be
attitude.
Arrested but, for anything.
But so the statute, you know, again, there's been a lot of lazy journalism about this, that the journalism I've seen that supposedly the statute says that they can have a 25-foot buffer zone and enforce it. It doesn't really say that. The text of the statute, I will read it out loud. It says, it's unlawful for a person, after receiving a verbal warning, not to approach from a person he or she knows reasonably should know as a first responder who engaged in the lawful performance of a legal duty, to knowingly and willfully violate such warning and approach or remain within 25 feet of the first responder with intent to, 1, impede or interfere with the first responder's ability to perform duty, 2, threaten the first responder with physical harm, or 3, harass the first responder. I think all of that was already illegal. If I see a fireman putting out a fire, I can't walk up to him and say, hey, how'd you like me to beat you up while he's trying to put out the fire, right? I can't interfere with him. I can't walk up to a police officer who's engaged in a shootout and say, hey, how come you're shooting at that guy?
But let's be real. More pointedly, this is about police on the street engaging with a citizen in some way, and an observer who is not a participant in that engagement sees what that observer believes to be some police misconduct. That's what we're talking about. You know, we're talking about, for example, Darnella Frazier, who's the teenager who filmed George Floyd's murder in a live stream video that quickly spread worldwide. In fact, she was awarded a Pulitzer Prize as a citizen journalist for having, created that video and distributed it to the public to show in stark terms how incomplete and how often fully misleading these early police reports to the public can be, when particularly in the case of interactions with cops and black men. So that's really what this is about. This is a law that was, you know, promulgated after the whole George Floyd incident. And it seems to be, at least to me, a reaction to that.
Oh, it absolutely is. Like a lot of things in Tallahassee, there's a grain of salt truth to it, and then there's what's really happening. That, remember, somebody tried to register Mickey Mouse to vote back in 2007, and that became the reason for all of these sweeping reforms that make it more difficult for people to cast ballots. And so similar to that, you know, there, it is true that, and I've heard police officers talk about, you're arresting somebody, you're in a tense situation, and a crowd starts to gather around you, and it can be tense, it can be scary.
Yeah.
And I understand that. I don't think it's a valid concern. I've never once heard of a group of strangers surrounding and lynching a police officer while he's trying to carry out an arrest. I mean, that's not something that happens, but I can understand how you would want to, if you feel intimidated, to say, okay, everybody back off. And there's a little bit of truth to that. But the real reason for this statute is because I'm looking right now at the press release that came out from the Minneapolis Police Department.
Yeah, I have that in my notes,
too. The day after
the original
George
police bulletin that came out to the public,
right,
reporting on what happened in the George Floyd incident, it says he was ordered to step from his car. After he got out, he physically resisted officers. Officers were able to get the subject into handcuffs and noted he appeared to be suffering medical distress. Officers called for an ambulance. He was transported to Hennepin County Medical Center by ambulance, where he died a short time later. That's totally false.
Well, I mean, it's omitting a very important part, which is that Derek Chauvin kneeled on his neck until he suffocated to death. That's not in the...
And that he had no pulse while they were still on the scene.
And we would know none of this if there weren't videotapes. We would only have Derek Chauvin's account, which he would have omitted any part where he was at fault. George Floyd himself can't really give his side of the story. Those videotapes were important. And I don't know if from 25 feet away you could have caught the dialogue.
Yeah, I was unable in my research to find out exactly how far away Darnella Frazier was from George Floyd and Derek Chauvin when she filmed that. I couldn't get that information in any of the reports I saw.
You can see from one another's tapes how close they were. I'd say she was maybe 10 feet away, but close enough to hear the audio.
Yeah.
25 feet. What's interesting is that in the earlier versions of this bill, it said 14 feet until a couple of days before it passed, and then it was expanded to 25 feet. But Darnella Frazier would not have violated the statute because she did nothing but stand there and record. And this law doesn't say you have to move if you are ordered to move. It says that you're only violating it if you remain within 25 feet with intent to interfere with the officer,
right,
or harass.
But let's be real. If you don't move after you're asked to move, because there is a provision in the law that says after warning, you know, so you have to be told move back, move away, or move 25 feet. You have to be told to move, essentially. But if you don't move after being told to move, they're going to arrest you now. Let's be real. They're going to arrest you because they can. And then later, if you get a lawyer and your lawyer challenges the arrest on the grounds that there was no probable cause to arrest you because there was no intent to harass, intimidate, or obstruct the officer in their duties, maybe the charge will be dismissed, but there's still a bunch of serious consequences that come to people who are arrested, even if their charges are dismissed.
So you've put your finger on, there's two trends I'm seeing in Tallahassee right now. One of them is this authoritarian trend toward preemption, that Tallahassee will make decisions for the rest of the state. We won't have you having mandatory heat and water breaks for your workers in Miami. We'll decide what's best for you. But the other trend is this chilling effect.
Excuse me, but I have a text message or an email here from Howard in Clearwater, Florida, who says just that. He talks about how all of these laws that I mentioned in the early part introduction of the show today, and the laws that you just, you know, referred to with respect to preemption, they're all examples of Tallahassee exceeding authority, regardless of whether they are dealt with in other parts of the law. And I think I think that's right.
Yeah,
you know?
Trying to centralize authority. But the other thing that you see a lot of lately is these laws that are very vague vague but have really severe consequences, right? So it's unclear what the Florida Supreme Court says it's constitutionally impermissible for the legislature to use such vague and broad language that a person of common intelligence must speculate about its meaning and be subject to arrest and punishment if the guess is wrong. So if you're going to make a criminal statute, you have to be very clear what you're not allowed to do. If it's unclear whether you're allowed to do it or not, then you're allowed to do it, right? The statute has to be clear what you're not allowed to do. So if I'm standing there recording the police and they say, you have to move back, I would say, I have no intent to harass or interfere with you, and I'm going to stand here silently and film. Now, what would happen then? I would probably be arrested, right? Especially if it's an officer who doesn't like my attitude, right?
And hopefully somebody recorded that interaction between right. you and the police, saying, I have no intent to harass or obstruct you, I'm just recording.
Sure.
If somebody needs to record that interaction.
And I can't tell you how many times, and you know as well, that people would complain to the ACLU that they had been arrested for recording the police and that the police had deleted the recording that they made. So what happens then? Well, then I get arrested and fingerprinted, and there's a mugshot out there, and I gotta pay somebody from that for pay mugshot site to remove it, and all my prospective employers see that, and I get strip searched. And
yeah, maybe hire a lawyer.
Right. Maybe I spend the weekend in jail. Maybe they throw me in a cell with somebody who beats me up. And then at the end of it, they say, oh, sorry, I guess you didn't violate the statute after all. But all of that is enough to deter me from doing something that I'm constitutionally allowed to do.
And that's the problem with these kinds of laws. All right. I want to just raise something else to you that struck me as I was preparing this show, and that is, in the same week that these laws were signed by DeSantis, the Fifth District Court of Appeal in Daytona Beach threw out some felony wiretapping convictions against a defendant, Michael Leroy Waite, who taped the Citrus County Sheriff's Office, who tape recorded a conversation that he had with a sheriff's deputy from Citrus County. He'd been involved in this long-standing dispute with the county over what he claimed was their trespassing on his property to put some herbicide there or whatever. But what the relevance of it is that in this case that came out of the Daytona Beach, the 5th DCA, was a decision that phone conversations with Florida law enforcement can be recorded without the consent of the law enforcement officer. Now, this is a big deal. This is a big decision because up until now, and we'll have to see if this goes beyond the 5th DCA into the rest of Florida or whether it's just binding now on the 5th DCA. I'm sure it's going to be appealed. But, you know, this law in Florida is that we are a two-party consent state for recording conversations. That means that both parties to any telephone call, for example, have to consent to being recorded. And that's been the law forever, and that's why Michael Waite was charged with recording this law enforcement officer. But apparently the Fifth Circuit now says that, you know, you can record law enforcement without their consent when they're in the pursuit of their duties. So, you know, I think that that's incredible, you know, that they made that decision, saying essentially that police have no expectation of privacy when they're conducting official business. And it doesn't seem to matter, you know, where they're conducting that official business. So how do we square this decision with this new law that restricts people from getting so close to first responders and recording them in public? Do you think this new law will be challenged in court on First Amendment grounds or on vagueness grounds? And what's meant by this intent to interfere with a person who gets closer than 25 feet?
Well, it was already against the law to interfere with a first offender, so it's unclear exactly what this adds. But hilariously, the staff analysis concedes that there's vagueness problems here. Like 25 feet from where? From where the officer was when they gave the warning? If the officer moves, does that 25-foot zone move with the officer, or does it?
And none of this is clarified in the statute, right?
Correct. The statute does say harass. They define that as causing substantial emotional distress to the officer. But the I don't think the courts are going to be
so subjective,
right? And substantial.
And officers are supposed to be trained in like de-escalation and in controlling their emotions so they don't escalate a confrontation with a citizen, you know, in a way that moves into violence. I mean, they're trained to not be emotionally. What is it that you said? Emotionally
distressed.
Emotionally distressed.
The courts are not going to be sympathetic to the argument that just being recorded at all subjected someone to emotional distress. It's funny because 6 or 7 years ago, Dr. Jennifer Morley and I sent public records requests to all of the law enforcement agencies in our 5-county area and asked, do you have a written policy about what to do when somebody's recording you? And I'm looking at a May 30, 2014 memo from the
2014.
Yeah, from the sheriff's office. And it says, a citizen's right to film public, it's quoting a federal case, a citizen's right to film government officials, including law enforcement officers, in the discharge of their duties in a public space is a basic, vital, and well-established liberty safeguarded by the First Amendment. And then they say mere annoyance and inconvenience to the deputy are not justifications to curb the right to record in public. So the right to record is not touched by this new statute. It's still there. And I understand the case saying that if you can record a deputy or law enforcement officer in public, why couldn't you record them on the phone? They're certainly recording on their end if they're investigating you. So why wouldn't you get to record them in the discharge of their duties? Sometimes having that recording can
yes.
be the difference between, you know, the jury believing what your recollection or the officer's recollection.
Right.
They're going to tend to believe the officer unless you've got a recording that shows otherwise.
Right.
And the interesting part about that is body-worn cameras.
Yeah.
They didn't even consider it.
They're going to be recording or not, you know, if they...
And they may or may not, but if they do, then that actually agrees with what the individual may be doing.
Well, you know, there's an exemption in the law. Police are allowed to record without the person's consent in the course of an investigation. There's an exemption to that two-party consent rule anyway.
And this 2014 memo actually addresses that recording, and it doesn't say, it's funny that they actually tried to prosecute somebody it's a felony in Florida to record without consent, but the sheriff's policy says, if a citizen informs a deputy that he's recording their telephone conversation, the deputy can inform the citizen that he does not consent to being recorded while on the telephone, and if the citizen refuses to stop the recording, the deputy can politely terminate the conversation.
Yeah,
it doesn't say to arrest them and charge them with a felony.
No, but that is exactly the point of this Fifth Circuit case, a 50 CA case, that is now saying, no, you know, he can terminate the conversation, but you are not going to be arrested for a felony for recording the officer in the discharge of his duties. I'm sorry, but that's all the time we have for today, because it's been a really interesting discussion. And I want to thank my guests, Attorney James Shaw, who is the former chair of the statewide legal panel for the state of Florida ACLU, and Dr. Carolyn Hepburn-Collins for being with us here today to talk about these issues. I want to thank our intrepid WMNF production volunteers, Jessica Green on the soundboard, and Barbara Fling, who answers your calls. And I want to always thank you, our listeners, for joining us. We really appreciate your attention to the show and your support for Midpoint and for WMNF, your independent community radio station. I'd like to invite you now to stay tuned for Duncan Strauss with Talking Animals. He is up next. And I think that his show today is going to be on Peace of Mind, a service to keep hospice patients together with their pets. So stay tuned for Talking Animals after Midpoint. We will be back next week with some other topic that hopefully will interest you. And we are WMNF Tampa.
satisfied.